You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. This week on the pod, it's all about the filmmakers behind the film, Tatina. And today's guest is art director and production designer, Emma McCann. Let me share a little about the film before we begin. It's based on the thrilling story of polar explorer Roald Amundsen and Italian engineer Umberto Nobile. Tatina tells a truish story of glory and defeat, seen through the eyes of the street dog that became the world's first four-legged celebrity who traveled to the North Pole in a Zeppelin. Sounds fun, right? It is! I love this movie. The film is hand-drawn in 2D, interspersed with real-life footage, and it was produced in Norway and Belgium. So grab a beverage of your choice, sketch while you listen if you like, and enjoy.
Hi, I'm Emma McCann. I'm an art director at the moment and a background painter in animation, mostly working in 2D feature films. What brings me joy about animation? I love to see the work of people I know. And that always brings me joy and happiness to know someone and see how they've gotten into an area they wanted to get into, or made a short film which they've been talking about for years and years. I love animation when I was a kid, and it never occurred to me as it could be a job that I could work in. So it's always amazing whenever I see real people that I know have actually worked in animation, have actually made something.
Yeah, I love watching all the credits to movies and TV. I'm like, who worked on this? Do I know anyone? And then I just like quietly celebrate over in my corner. Or I send them a DM and I'm like, oh my God, it was so good.
Yeah,
it's nice. It's like a yearbook a little bit.
Yes.
So saying that, like, you know, you didn't know that it could be a job. What was the moment you realized it could be a job?
I think it was very late, actually, for me. I went to art school, but even at art school, it didn't occur to me to do animation. I kind of went down a rabbit hole, I suppose. I did printmaking, etching, lithography, and stuff like that. Fine art printmaking. And the way the college worked, it was an art college in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And they were kind of pushing everyone to kind of an abstract expressionism, so very conceptual art, very abstract. And I really wasn't really there. I didn't really get that. And so I kind of dropped out without really physically dropping out. Kind of mentally, I wasn't really there. I had a part-time job and I worked longer hours there, and I went out with my friends, and I didn't really get very much out of art school because of that. They discouraged watercolor painting, and I used to love watercolor painting. They didn't like that, so it actually took me years before I started painting again. I started watercolor painting years after I left art school. I worked in a technical job. I didn't draw at all, gradually I started painting again, and then I went back to college. It kind of like, I suppose you call a further education college, a community college, not like a big art school like I'd been to before. And it was a two-year course, and it covered many kinds of things in multimedia. So there was shooting video, editing sound, a bit of web design, but programming, and there was animation. And I did 2D animation and 3D animation, and I didn't really like 3D, but I loved the 2D. It was just flash, but it was the first time I kind of realized how you could totally invent characters and invent things and animate things, and I could do it. It wasn't just, you know, strange people that I would never meet who worked on Disney films, and it just seemed so remote. So I loved being able to do it, and I thought I could actually work in animation. Maybe there's jobs in animation that I've never heard of until now. And I had a look around, but actually there's not that much in Scotland in the animation industry. There's quite a lot of games, 3D games, but there's not really kind of 2D stuff that I thought I would like to. But at that moment, actually, I was incredibly lucky because just when I graduated and searched online for animation jobs, they came up, The Illusionist, Sylvain Chomy was making The Illusionist, his second film, in Edinburgh, which was about 60 miles from where I was. And they were looking for juniors in the art department. And that was kind of incredible because it was a feature film. It was a big French director who'd already had a lot of success with The Tribulations of Bilbo, his first film. And I'd seen that, and that was very inspiring for me. So I applied there, and I got a job there. That was, and I was incredibly lucky because my flash animations were not good at all, and that would not have got me a job there. But I had all these watercolor paintings that I'd done, and they were enough to get me a test in the background department, in the art department, and I got that. So that
That's
was my first job.
amazing that the thing that the fine art college didn't appreciate in your work is what got you your first job.
I thought
Amazing.
that was ironic too, because it was being made in Edinburgh, so sometimes the studio got applications from the art school, and I could see that it was kind of going the same direction. A lot of the portfolios were very abstract stuff and probably very good fine art, but when they were looking for people who could draw layout or could, design color, it didn't really show that in the portfolio. So I was lucky that I had these watercolors. Really lucky, because I didn't have anything else. My degree by itself from the art school would not have got me a job,
Yeah, it's always the work. I find it I mean, it's not really fascinating. It's really unfortunate that a poor education experience like that, where you're like discouraged from the things that you're drawn to the most, can really like set you astray for a while. Like I've known people that's happened. Luckily, the people I'm thinking about have rekindled their love of art.
You
But
bounce
like
back.
that time spent not doing it, but it's yeah, I'm so glad you got back on the path you wanted to be, or it got clearer and clearer, Yeah. What was it like finally being in a studio setting? Like, were you like, I definitely want to do this like forever?
Yeah, definitely. It was wonderful. It was so exotic compared to, well, I mean, I guess about maybe 8 months before I started, I was working in a shop, and then after that, I had a job in a kind of little studio in Glasgow, but I wasn't doing anything creative. Well, I was doing programming, very light programming, kind of scripting, JavaScript, ActionScript, stuff like that.
Oh.
But I wasn't drawing. I wasn't creating. Because that was part of my course as well, and it was a part I quite enjoyed as well. But yeah, so going in there for the first time, I remember I went into a room to do my test, and I was in a room with three French guys, which was already so exotic. They were all speaking French and ignoring me, and there was a Cintiq, and I'd never seen a real Cintiq before. I'd only seen them in pictures online. I just thought myself a like this Wacom tablet, Intuos chat tablet, thankfully. So it wasn't completely new to me because it was a test on backgrounds. I just remember being, blown away by how exotic and how romantic it all seemed, a real animation studio. They were just setting up though then. There was hardly anyone there. I remember there was empty rooms with just a telephone sitting in the middle of the room. That was in June in 2006. And then I got the job, but it took a while. They tested me twice. There took ages to get back to me. You felt there was a lot of change of staff going on in the production side. And if finally, I started in January. And when I went back, that was in 2007, there was loads of people. And what struck me was how young so many people seemed. The animators, some of the juniors, they were just in their early 20s. They were just straight out of art school. Everyone was from all over the world, or all over Europe, certainly. I know there was Americans too, Canadians, Australians, Indians, and there was every country in Europe represented. And there weren't that many Scottish people. I think there was only three of us in Edinburgh. So it felt like, I suppose it felt like being when you go to university abroad or something, and everyone's from everywhere else, and you meet lots of people from everywhere. It felt like that, except it was a job. So it was really a crazy experience, and I was very happy to be there. And yes, I did want to do it that forever, and I knew nothing about it, so I was kind of hiding how little I knew. While I did the job, I was the assistant to the art director, and also I was doing character color, so the base character color for the characters, and then the integration for the film. And I was learning as I went. I had there was a very good art director who knew an awful lot and trained me, quite tough, but I kind of needed that because I knew nothing. I remember one day I said to in the room, before this I was working in programming, and Isabel Stenhouse, she does layout, she was sitting next to me and she said, shh, she was afraid I would be fired if they knew how little I actually knew.
Oh
But I learned quickly, and I heard about Annecy and how wonderful that was. We went to Annecy for the first time, and I had a steep learning curve, but I was enjoying it. I was just very, very happy to be in a place where I wasn't working in a shop and I was doing something creative and surrounded by so many amazing people who were so talented, amazing
yeah.
animators and amazing color artists.
Did you since it sounds like jobs over there are also gig to gig for the most part. Like that's how it is over here too. Like, did you find yourself having to go back to working in a shop or going to coding? Like when, like
No,
if
I
things
was
were
quite
ever.
lucky. After I finished on The Illusionist, I went to Bristol and did a short course in stop motion animation because I always really loved stop motion, and it kind of exists as a community quite separate from 2D. There's not much crossover. So the people I knew from The Illusionist, they all worked in 2D, or that's what they wanted to work in, and they didn't know anyone from stop motion. So I did a course and I really enjoyed that. But then I thought, I'll just apply and I'll get a job in stop motion. Like before, it would be dead easy. But of course, it wasn't. I couldn't get any job in stop motion. I didn't know anyone. I had no experience. So I kind of went back to 2D, kind of the color thing I was doing before. What did I do? Yeah, I went to Spain. Oh, yeah, that was, yeah. Briefly, I was in Spain. I couldn't find any jobs in the UK. I applied many places. I wrote out many CVs and reels and everything. And most animation studios are quite small and they have a set group of people they work with. They don't always have productions. I didn't have contacts really. I think it helps if you study animation at an art school in Scotland and then you know people from the group and they know people in different studios. But I didn't have those kind of contacts. All my contacts were European. And after the film finished, they all went back to France, went back to Germany, back to Belgium, and it was kind of over. So I went to Spain. There was a bunch of them working in Spain. I did cleanup. I'm so bad at cleanup. I did cleanup for a brief time on
I like that you admit that you're bad at it. I'm
Oh,
sure you're not
I
actually bad
hadn't
at
done
it.
it.
Like,
I hadn't done
yeah.
any cleanup. And it was a really, well, I wouldn't say a bad film, but it was a bad film. Right? It was
Cool.
a Chinese funded and kind of Disney knockoff called Little Big Panda. It's never been released or even on
Okay.
streaming platforms, I don't think. It might have been released in China. I think it probably was. But it was paid so low, it was cheaper for them to do it in Spain. Like that's how low we were paid. I think I earned 600 euros, which is about the same as $600 for 3 months.
Whoa.
Whoa.
What year was that? I mean, like, I guess
Oh yeah.
anytime in
If it
the
was the 50s, it'd be
2000s,
okay.
yeah.
I think it was 2010, 2010.
Yeah, that's, yeah, not enough. And I know
<That's>
that you weren't alive in the 50s. Like, you don't look that old. Just to clarify.
Yeah, but no, I wasn't great. I was terrible as well, and it was paid per drawing. Sometimes, quite often, other Spanish animators who are friends of mine have said that they are paid quite often by drawing, in Spain, or they
So
were.
is that
And so it
typical
was 2 euros
still?
a drawing. Yeah,
Oh,
I don't know
wow.
if they still do that, but it was 2 euros a drawing, and I was very slow. So yeah, it's probably my fault. I was paid so low. I just yeah. Anyway, I did that for a while, and then I got a job in Angoulême in France, which is where I still am, on a feature film doing kind of what I did on The Illusionist: color design, color characters, and
And
integration.
Angoulême is the comics festival place, right? In France.
Yes,
Like, I want to visit
it
someday. If you're still
is. It's
there, I'll
yeah.
meet
Have you been there?
No, it's on my list of places to visit, though.
Yeah, well, you should come. It's a really nice town city. It's well, they have the comic books. That's really big here. The festival's on in January, and it's mostly French and Belgian, but all kind of European comics, independent comics, piles and piles, and it's just for miles. It's like
Oh, it's so
overwhelming
cool.
if you like comics.
Yeah.
And then around that, there's kind of the animation industry has grown up and grown up. because there's a bit of crossover in France between animation and comics. You know,
That
people
was
get
going to
their
be my next
comics
question.
adapted. And and they, and then people also maybe do comic books, but it's not very well paid. It's not very reliable a wage, so they do a bit of animation as well, or they work as, you know, doing cleanup, and then they do their comic book and they go back and forth.
Yeah, same over here. Same over
So
here. Wow.
but there's yeah, there I read online that there are now about 33 animation studios in Angoulême, and that they produce in Angoulême about half the output of France in a year.
Wow.
It's like, even though it's a small place, there are many, many studios here. So that's good. A lot of people come here to work on one production, and then, like me, they end up staying, or they kind of settle here because there's work, and you know,
That's
it's good.
incredible. Jeez. Okay, so what was the point that like you became a supervisor or like, you know, became art directing and overseeing other people?
Well, that would be on Titina. That was my first experience as an art director. But before that, but I was supervisor of character color on The Illusionist. I had two people under me, and on Zarafa as well. I think there was one guy under me. But I mean, usually, I wasn't actually supervising the whole thing until Titina. Before, and the two features I did before that, I was just sort of background painter or research and development background painter, but I wasn't supervised.
Yeah. Is it what does it feel like to like bounce between roles like that where it's like, oh, on this film you're an art director, on the next one you like go down to supervising or like, you know.
I'm okay with that. I think the industry here is kind of like that. People change roles all the time. If you're the supervisor on one film, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will be on the next film. You might move to another studio. Most often you will move to another studio, work on a different production. So people are always switching being supervisor, and then maybe being supervised by someone they supervised. That's happened to me as well.
So funny, yeah.
So as you have to, you know, always be nice because you never know.
Right.
Which is good. It's nice. It keeps everyone modest and humble, and everyone is, you know, no one gets too big for their boots because, you know, roles are always shifting and people are always shifting. I've worked as a background painter, just background painter on the last two projects, which were just short films, so it was very short contracts. I might supervise again. I don't know. We'll see.
That's cool. And one of my favorite like examples of like this kind of scenario is like, you know, like someone's an executive producer or showrunner of a show, and then the next show that they're on, they're like character designing. Like it happens, you know. Yeah, I think that's really cool. And I think it's fun because like it seems like it would be very stressful to be an art director. So it might be nice to go and like paint backgrounds for a while
Oh
before
yeah,
taking that
for
on
sure.
again.
I really I wouldn't want to go straight from one big long, especially a feature was like 3 years on that, to go straight onto something else like that. It's not possible. I don't think you just be, you need a bit of a change. And just going in, putting on your headphones and background painting, it was lovely after, you know, Titina was lovely too, but it was nice just to kind of like take a step back. That was really cool. So I don't know what I'll do next, but yeah, I like to work on Titina. It was a wonderful experience. And it
It's
was
a
kind of,
wonderful movie. So that's
I
great to
like
hear
it.
that the experience was great. Yeah, I love it.
Well, it was a tough one as well because it was during COVID. Everyone has their during COVID pandemic experience. And this was one that started, and we were to move as well. We had to move to Belgium, which is you know, it's an 8-hour drive from where we are. And it's a different country with different administration and everything. So, and it was during COVID, and we had a 6-month-old baby, and so it was like a big, it was a big, you know, massive kind of change of lifestyle and whole world lifestyle, I guess, with COVID. But it was nice, and we were in Belgium for 2 years, or just less than 2 years, for the production. And the funny thing is that even though we moved there to be like on the spot to work in the studio with everyone, we had to be there. We were told we couldn't work from Ungoliant, we have to go to Belgium. So we went to Belgium, we were in the studio for a month, and then we were all working from home. So we were in the apartment that we'd rented.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, like, and this is probably terrible to say, it's unfortunate it couldn't have happened a month earlier, right? So then you could have just not moved. Yeah. And I know how bad that is to say.
Yeah, I know. But actually, it was a nice experience being in Belgium. Brussels is a wonderful city. I always wanted to live there. Of course, that was when I was younger, and I was thinking, look at all these amazing bars and these amazing clubs. It'll be so cool to be here and going out and seeing friends. And but then when we go there, we were, we have a baby, and it's COVID and everything shut, so we didn't get to live our Belgian, dream lifestyle. But that's okay.
So as an art director, like what do you do? Like what does that role entail?
Well, I guess it depends on the job. It depends on the project. I think art directors would maybe do different things on different kinds of projects.
That makes
But
sense.
I did. I started doing basic production design. I kind of, black and white, very quite cold and technical designs for the locations in the film, and that was mainly because the storyboarders needed that to see what's the room like, what's behind the character, how do we set up stuff. And that was interesting because it was kind of a back and forth with the storyboarders, because I would do the room and I would put things where I think they should be, and then the storyboarders would say, actually, can we move this chair here or this board here, because then we can do a nice, overlay, we can have things in the foreground, things in the background, and it's going to like set up the shot nicer. So they would move things around in the storyboard, and then I would move things around in my design so that we fitted the storyboard. So we went back and forth a bit to try and find what was the optimum placing of everything for the camera. And then after that, I moved to concepts because they wanted to see some color. And I think I was doing about two a week of all the locations. We had a list of every important location in the film, because they're traveling. The locations change quite a lot, different kinds of weather, and different interiors, exteriors, different landscapes. So I think we did quite a lot. We did, I don't know, maybe 60 or something concepts of various places.
Well,
And after that, I was on maternity leave for 4 months. And then when I came back, I did the color script. And that was just before production started. And that was for the whole film. I did the color script with Sarah Williamson, who's a background painter who and designer who replaced me, covered me when I was off. And we both did the concepts and we both did the color script. And that was really cool. And then the background team started. And I think sometimes the art director would have not really supervised directly background team, but I did. So they started, and it was more day to day, just supervising. Like I said, they started in the studio for a month, and then they were all working from home. So it kind of, it was a lot of online stuff, online meetings and meetings and chat
so many
and
meetings.
stuff like that. But it was nice. They were all really, really nice people. They were there for about 6 months, maybe 5 months, I think 5 months. And when they finished, I worked on the character integration. So the character colors had already been set up for the film, the one base color for the whole film, and then I integrated the characters in every scene. So with overlays, and then I made a reference for compositing. So compositing would copy the same integration. I've done that on, I did that on Illusionist, I did it on Red Turtle, and I think it's very important because it helps the characters feel that they're part of the environment. And also there's a kind of design that went into making them. We weren't having rim lights. Sometimes they put there's no shadows animated on the characters, so you don't have dark and light on the character. But sometimes compositing will put in a rim light, which just kind of puts an edge of light on the 2D characters. But we weren't doing that either, so we wanted to try and keep it as graphic, simple as possible. So if we have the characters all in a room that's quite dark, then one of them could be bright because there's light coming in from a window, and then you get a feeling that there's light and there's dark without lighting the edge of every single character. So that was something that we focused on. We did the integration. No, it was so important because it was so graphical and so simple, the backgrounds and the characters. And I was afraid that in compositing they might want to put in rim lights and things like that, which kind of conform more to what you know, people might expect to see, but I think it would ruin the, not ruin, but it would break the graphic design that we had for the whole film. It needed to be very simple, and it was more a case of giving them a design, a reference that said, do less, don't add things, don't make it more busy than it needs to be, keep it very, very simple. So that's why we did it.
Yeah. I
So
feel
that
like,
that
because
took, yeah.
I've been using the word simple to describe the look of this film, but I also feel like it's deceivingly simple. I don't know. I just love how you're talking about the choices you made, and like it seems like the way you knew to make those choices was just kind of gut instinct, you know, and thinking about what was best for this film and not how it fit into the landscape of what other people did. So I think that's so incredible that you stuck to that.
Yes, I did. I did. I was a stick in the mud about that. I
No,
really
that's not
couldn't.
what it is. We are not going to
Yeah,
call you a stick in the mud here.
I wonder if it was so important that it looks like this. Yes, okay. Yeah. Yeah, no, we did that, and then comp went on quite long, and then during the end of comp, I also did the posters and the logo for the film. And that was the kind of last job, I think.
Yeah, a Swiss Army knife of the Totino team,
Yeah.
clearly. So, you know, you, because like you mentioned doing some production design. What is the difference between production design and art directing?
I'm not really sure. I think I was called by Tonya to work on the film as an art director, and my job all the way through, I was called the art director. That was what was on my contract, and that's what I thought my job was. And then when they were doing the credits at the end, they put production designer. But I guess I think that part of what the job I did was production designer. I thought that I would see production design as the design of the backgrounds. What's in the background? Where's the door? Where's the table? What does it look like? Like you have production design for live action films, you know, it's the design for the set. But I was doing more than that. I was doing color design and design for, you know, the lines of the effects, things like that. And yeah, so I guess production design was part of what I did, but it wasn't everything. But I
I
think
see.
Tonya said she thought that production design was just what art directors are called in America. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm trying to think of credits like on, you know, like the features. And I feel like there's production design, then there's art directors. And I think the art directors do more specific things,
Yeah.
you know, while the production designer like oversees. But that's like on really big
Yeah.
productions. And like, I don't know if I know what I'm talking about here. Like, I've done a lot of reading, but I'm not sure if I'm getting it. But
You
live
probably know more than
action,
me. I'm really not sure at all.
oh, I doubt it. Like, I'm still learning. But in you mentioned live action, because like they also have like I'm pretty sure they have set designers as well. And I would think that production design is setting the look of the entire film,
Yeah.
like, you know, like the style, you know,
Yeah.
brief that you're gonna find, and then helping your people find that. And you had your fingerprints all over Satina, and I think it's 100% deserved to be called a production designer.
Well, good.
Yeah. Can you talk about what inspirations you pulled into your designs on Satina?
Oh yeah, that was well, Kaisa, when I first met her, she's so wonderful. I first met her when I went to Oslo in February, the year I started, for an interview, kind of. And we talked about who we are inspired by. And she sent me a kind of a folder with all these artists, and there was so much stuff. But I noticed there was some things with like a sort of staircase that curls around, and like sort of twisted architecture on the buildings. And I was started to think about Art Nouveau. I always love Art Nouveau, and the kind of curving, the kind of plant light, not too ornate, but just the way, the simple way that things curve, the lines curve in furniture and architecture and paintings, Mucha and things like that. So I was looking at Charles Rennie Mackintosh. She's a Scottish architect and painter, and he used to paint, he used to draw on his architectural drawings these little fir trees with lots of swirling lines that were round and round and looked and looked. And I thought, that's really lovely. If we could use that to describe the abstract things in the film, things that are not architecture, like clouds and snow and trees. And then we can loop it round and loop it round. And then also the line will cut up the object into areas that we can paint different colours to create a volume. So that's what we did. And I started with a design for the clouds, and Kaiser liked it. So we then we did the trees and the ground. And I referred sometimes to his drawings, but what he didn't really draw like that. It was specifically the trees that he did. He did these little swirling trees. So we looked at some stuff he did, and then his watercolor paintings as well that he did towards the end of his life. And he used kind of very nice lines as well, very thin lines and crossing over. So I think what we've done is a kind of an adaptation of what he did in some of his work rather than a direct copy of what he did. But I was very inspired by him always. There's little touches of Macintosh different places in the film.
Very lovely. I think that, you know, in going into like the settings and stuff, I love the difference between Italy and then more up north, and how like the style doesn't like completely change, but like warm colors versus cold colors. Yes. And then like the warmth of swoops in Italy, and then it gets a little sharper, you know, going up north. Like it's not like sharp all over, but like there are more, there are a lot more at hard edges, right? Is that something that came organically as like the story developed?
Yeah, I think so. Kaiser wanted there to be a clear difference between the, you know, the warmth of the south, the dark shadows and the warm sun and the north, because that was going to emphasize the point that Titina had no business being in the north, because she's, you know, a little lapdog from Italy, and she's used to comfort and sunshine. We covered in the colour script the difference between the bright Italy and the bright north. It's a different kind of bright. It has the cool, the blues, the greens, but you know, everything is in the sky, all the colors, because the ground is just, you know, very very white and almost too brilliant to look at with the white, you know? So it's actually very very white in the film. When you watch it in the cinema, when they're flying over the North Pole, and you can see a lot of the ground, you can feel the light on the audience because a big flash. Yeah, in Italy, it's actually darker because of all the shadows, but there's, you know, much more contrast, the bright yellow next to a dark blue, and you feel the kind of Mediterranean colours with that. So we set it out in the colour script, I think, initially. This is where it's going to be lighter, this is where it's going to get darker. Kaiser wanted for the North Pole to be very boring, because the idea was these guys are going to find something spectacular, and they thought they would be mountains or, you know, something very extraordinary on the North Pole. We were looking at maps of the sort of fantastical maps that have been made of the North Pole before anyone traveled there, and they have like sea monsters and mountain ranges and all these things that they thought would be there. And there was, and one of the funny ironic things about the exhibition is they arrive there and there's nothing, it's just flat, it looks exactly like Miles Around, and there's nothing interesting at all, it's just flat. So that was quite important, you know, flat white, and nothing really going on at all. And then later on in the film, we're back in Italy, and you get the sort of shock of the, you know, the bright film again.
Yeah, I really love all of the research that goes into, you know, making these decisions. I think it's my favorite thing about writing in general is all the research. You learn about things you never thought you'd be Googling or looking up in a library. Right. What is, like, as art director, what is the relationship with your director like? Like, it seems like you had a lot of conversations up front, but like we're very much in communication the entire way through.
Yeah, we really were. When I started, they had started storyboarding and they were still adapting the script. They hadn't finished the script. And so, yeah, I had great conversations with Kaiser when we first went, and then we were constantly in contact. The idea had been that I would go to Oslo and work in Oslo next to Kaiser, but I was pregnant, and with that comes lots of checkups and doctor's appointments and stuff like that, so it wasn't practical. So I stayed out in Ogulem, and I worked remotely, and we did meetings online every week. I went to Oslo another 2 times for I think 2 weeks, and then 3 weeks throughout the year. And yeah, we talked about everything. Kaiser's great. She has ideas about everything. She's She's very enthusiastic about new ideas, and she'd been working on this for a long time, so she knew exactly what she wanted, but she was exploring still with the storyboarders, ideas about changing how the characters are communicating, especially in some moments in the film. Like I think the telephone call came out of the storyboarding, like the sort of split screen, which is really, really nice.
Favorite scene. I love
Yeah,
that.
great, great. So yeah, we talked constantly and right till the end, like really going back and forth. And it was hard at the end. It was compositing, like often in feature films, has so much pressure at the end because everything is a bit late and that's the deadline and they have everything at the end. So it was stressful, but Kaiser was always, on it. She was really, really great. And we were, I mean, still in touch afterwards for talking about other things and talking about the poster, then talking about the premiere, and it's been a long relationship. She came to Ongoland as well when we were working in compositing, which was really cool. It was she goes the extra mile. She's really good.
That's amazing. Like you mentioned the poster, and it's such a beautiful poster. One of my favorite like details is the ice when it goes into the water. So like the ice starts breaking up into patches, and then it starts kind of gliding into the water, body of water, and the line color that you use changes from like the ice outline to the water outlining
All
the
right.
pieces of ice as they go away. Anyways, I thought it was an incredible. Now I
Yeah.
gotta look this up to make sure that that's actually what's on there. It's
I
somewhere
did
in the movie, and I was like, wow, so cool.
we did a poster at me and Kaiser would like to do. Posters are quite interesting. Like there are always a big fight over them at the end of the film, but like we wanted to do one where you see Titina kind of in a close-up on the balcony of the airship. And then you have the title, and then on the bottom you have the airship, like as a kind of lot far away. I think she was kind of inspired by Porco Rosso, where you see Porco Rosso in his airplane close up, and then you see the airplane far away as well. So you have the two, like two shots.
Oh, that's neat.
So that's the one we did, and we proposed it to the sales agent, who was the French sales agent at the time, because they were releasing it in France, and they didn't want to do that because they found it wasn't commercial enough. So we had to do another poster which has all the characters, Titina running at the camera, lots of action, 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 and bright color. So that was the official poster. And I think in most countries that's still the official poster, but the poster in our hearts is the first poster we did, which I still got to do because we did Norwegian, in Norway they had a character poster, so an individual poster per character. So Titina's is our poster.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I have a speaker.
And it's nice that like you have the artwork so you could print it out for yourself.
There you go.
Oh,
It's
it's
a
so
little one.
cute. Yeah, that's adorable. I love that.
No.
So it was so the image I was talking about is not the it's not the
No.
poster. It was one of your backgrounds. I'll just share it with you real quick. I feel so silly that I got that wrong.
Yeah.
It's this one. I just love that the lines in the ice, they're
Yeah.
white, but as they
Yes.
start going off into the ocean, you change it to blue, and
Yeah.
it's such a small detail, but it's just so well observed, you
Yeah,
know?
I really like that background. That was one of the concepts. That was when we were trying to tie down the lines on the ice. What are the lines on the ice going to be like? That's a nice one. In fact, we never see that location from that point of view. That we only see it from near down, near the ground, near the ice, or down below.
You know, maybe that's an interesting question. So with a location that is like all snow and ice and very white, like how do you find a differentiating view, you know, to make the shots interesting?
We depend an awful lot on the weather then and on the time of day, and we cheat an awful lot because actually they did the expedition in summertime, which meant that it would be almost completely daytime all the time, from the north of Norway to the north of
Right.
Alaska. They wouldn't have much night at all. I mean, really almost none. But we have quite often we have scenes where the obviously it looks like the sun is setting or rising. There's long shadows, and because it just looks nicer. And so we cheated a lot. That you wouldn't have got that kind of light. So we cheated with the light, like when they're on the Svalbard, which is the island north of Norway, where they set off from there on the airship. The sky is light and the snow is dark because it's like the sun is set and the ground is darker. So you still have this experience of kind of blue, cold, but you don't have bright white snow, even though it obviously would be bright white, but it's out sort of in the dusk, which makes it it gives it a different atmosphere. And then when they arrive in Teller in Alaska, it was, I think they kind of thought in the storyboard that it was nighttime because they put in the moon, and it was very dark, and Tatina's lost and she has to find the airship. But later on, when we were looking at it in continuity, we realized that when they go into the telegraph office to send the telegraph, it's open, which means it can't be in the middle of the night. So we had to change it so that it's just a very, very bad storm with thick, dark clouds. And imagine the sun is, it's maybe 6 o'clock in the evening on a normal place where the sun is kind of going down. So it changed. We kind of cheated with that as well. And then when they're in the airship, because they're in the airship for an awful lot of the time, all you see out the window mostly is the sky and the clouds. So we had a lot of fun trying to decide which clouds would be in which sequence. It's not very often that the sky has, absolutely nothing in it. I think just before they arrive in the North Pole and when they leave the North Pole. But before that, there's little fluffy clouds or there's long line clouds. And then just before they crash, you start to have the storm clouds, big sort of orangey yellow clouds outside the window, which helped as well because you can feel the airship moving more when you can see the clouds. Because if the ground is completely flat and there's nothing in the sky, you don't really get the illusion of movement. It's not easy to provide the illusion of
Such
movement.
a good point. Yeah. That's so cool to hear about, 'cause making those creative decisions, even though it's not realism isn't the goal, it's the illusion, and it is a film, you want it to look good, and I think your solutions that you came to are so perfect, because I didn't even question time of days for any of it. I was just in it. Where do you find your motivation? Whether it's on a job or, in your career, keep finding work and all that.
Well, I think once I'm in a job, I'm fine because I find motivation in just trying to do what I'm supposed to be doing well. Whether that's painting backgrounds or helping other people paint backgrounds or designing, I always enjoy painting backgrounds, even in styles that I'm not really used to or new styles. I don't. Once I start a job, I tend to be okay. In between jobs. Sometimes I've thought I'm not going to work on that ever again. I want to do something different, but then I start a new job and it's okay. I love the industry and I love working in animation. But after a big job, sometimes you think, oh goodness, I wouldn't mind just working in a shop. Of course, I have worked in shops and it's still stressful and hard. It's not easier just because you're working in a shop. But I mean, yeah, no, I always want to go back. I just sometimes need a wee break after a big job, and then I'm good to go back, and I'm fine.
Yeah. I feel like I can be kind of a mess in between jobs, but yeah, sometimes you're like, I could use a break. For me, it's like I take the break for 4 days and then I'm like, it's over for me. And that's but then yeah, start the next job and it's so much better. It's like, okay, great. I'm not a failure. It wasn't just a fluke.
No, I mean, that's the thing with these jobs that we have, which is, contract to contract, and we don't have a. Sometimes I envy people that have their long permanent contracts that are forever and ever. But then, they know they're going back to the same job every day as well. So I don't know. I think we're lucky. And certainly when I was younger, I felt very lucky to always have variety in where I was working and who I was working with and what I was working on. I don't envy, apart from when, I'm trying to buy a house or something, and then I realize that I really need a permanent contract. If I had a permanent contract, everything would be much easier, but then I wouldn't have the variety.
Yeah, and you're right that getting to meet different groups of people and learn new things and new ways of working. I thought I always, when I was starting out, and like some days still, I think about how like Disney used to be, where like, oh, they worked there for 40 years and all these cool projects. Like, it would be amazing, And I was lucky to be at a studio for like 5 years. And like when I left, I didn't know what to do with myself. I was like, I lost all my people. All my friends worked there. I lost my mentor. Like, I was really sad about it. But like, I've met some really cool people since, and different ways of working. And I feel like my creative process, has also like evolved, and it's better. So good things and bad things. I still miss everyone that was there. But yeah, you move, and that's just what it is now. I'm not gonna say it's better. That's just the way
Yeah,
it
it's
is.
a different thing, and yeah, I've been working at home a lot recently as well, which is it has its good points, but I worked a little bit in a studio before the summer, and it was amazing just to go in and say hi to people and have a coffee and stuff like that. So I kind of miss that. But I've worked with really nice people from all over, and I really don't regret that. I think it's wonderful. But sometimes I'd really like to meet my friends and go for, go for lunch or go for a drink, but they're all living in,
So
Australia
far
and
away.
Oslo, and they're nowhere near me. So that's a downside as well.
It seems like you keep getting hired soon after you roll off a project. Like, do you have a personal creative practice?
I guess I maybe I used to. I haven't done any personal work for a really long time, which is really bad. I know that I keep reading things online that say you should draw one thing a day, and of course I agree with it as soon as I read it, and then I go to draw one thing and I get distracted tidying my drawing things, and then I don't do anything at all. So yeah, I used to do stop motion by myself at home, and I like to make models and puppets and do little animations, and I did watercolors. I still kept going with watercolors for a long time, but now I kind of have these ongoing jobs that I'm doing. So I'm working for people. So I do my drawing for people for a wage, and then once I finish that, I have a 3-year-old. I don't have time to draw when he's awake, when he's at home. So I guess I could maybe start doing something late in the evening or early in the morning. But so far I haven't been pushing myself to do that. I've been just working, and since I draw for work, I say, well, I'm drawing. It's not my
Oh,
personal
yeah.
drawing, but it's drawing. So
No, it's so true. And I see that all the time too. You should draw every day, you should write every day. And like, I do agree with it within reason, but sometimes I take a week off from writing and I write faster, the following week, and I don't know. There's something about rest that is also very
Yes,
important,
of course.
When your kid is old enough and going to school, you can do like lunchbox doodles or something.
Of course. I'm going to, I'm envisaging in a few years that I'm going to be starting to try to do more stuff, and maybe start little bits and pieces now. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's a big long summer holiday. It's just finished, so I'm just getting into the idea that, all summer holidays are finished. Now I can, maybe work on some stuff. So maybe I will.
When it's time, it'll be time. Do you feel like you're a curious person?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
How do
I
you
think.
like, keep that part of your interests alive, especially when like you're busy?
How do I keep being curious? I think I read a lot. That helps. I look at stuff online, but I try not to go too much down the route of social media and clicking on everything and looking at stupid stuff, because I end up spending ages looking at videos of people cleaning driveways with power washers, and it's very satisfying, but it's like, rubbish, rubbish, what are you looking at this for? Or people making
Maybe
things out of wood.
it's a type of rest, because I get about my videos like that too, where like animals falling asleep, I could watch forever, and I'm like, yeah.
Something satisfying about it, but yeah, staying curious, talking to people. I don't go out as much as I'd like to, or meet up with people for coffee as much as I'd like to, but I'm thinking I'm going to try to join a life drawing class here in Angoulême, and then also I can do life drawing, and I can meet people who are also artists, probably animation people from Angoulême.
Yeah. That's cool. I've just been thinking a lot about curiosity lately in play, so I thought I'd ask. It's a new question I've not asked on the podcast before, so it probably seems super random.
It's important to be curious. It definitely is. I can see that all the time. I love it when people are curious.
Yeah, me too.
I'm curious about, I mean, I'm meeting people now who are not working in animation because of the school, because my son going to nursery school. So it's like oh, what do you do? What do you do? And some people don't really care to be asked what they do because they're not, it's not really something they want to talk about. So I'm curious, but I have to be, you know, okay, maybe I'll leave it to them to tell me what to do. I won't just wade in there saying,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, it's like the first thing I want to tell anyone too. I work in animation. And
Yeah.
when I do get the opportunity to say it and they have no reaction, I'm just like so heartbroken. I'm like, it's like the coolest thing. How are you not
Yeah.
freaking out with me right now? But
It's like the coolest
yeah.
thing. Yeah, I suppose, yeah. If maybe if you're in a place where people aren't used to people working in animation, then it would be really, wow, really? That's really, because I would have been totally impressed if I had seen you when I was, you know, 16 years old at high school and you said I work in animation. I'd be like,
Yeah,
wow,
me too.
I didn't know
You're like, you kidding? Yeah.
that
In
was a job.
my small town, the job options were nurse, teacher, minor.
That's funny. That's the same for me. We were offered work experience. You know, when you're about 15, you do 1 week of work experience, and it was like, do you want the office? Do you want the hospital? Or I think there was one other thing, but it was like, yeah, there was no broadcasting or anything like that. You know,
Yeah.
it was very basic. I did the hospital. I was terrible. I should never work with people in hospital.
Oh my gosh. I feel like it would just be like really a difficult place. Yeah. My
Yeah,
mom's a
yeah.
nurse and I'm like, I don't know, I can't do it. I don't think I could ever do it. So looking forward in your career, like what is like your goals on this path? Like do you have like a blue sky that you're, you know, heading towards?
I don't know. I would like to do some of my own work. I don't know what form that would take. I made a short film before. I thought that maybe I could make another one, but it was an awful long, it takes an awful long time to make a short animated film, especially when you're working alone. Inevitably you get other ideas when you're halfway through and you start to think, oh, this is rubbish, I should do this other thing. And then you kind of, you know, leave off, and then, you know, it's a cycle of, you know, you'll never ever stay with the same idea for long enough to finish a short film, you know. And then, and even if you do, by the time you finish it, you'll be like, oh, I didn't want to make this. I wanted to make
Oh
something.
no. With your first short film, it was a stop motion, right?
Yeah.
How did you keep yourself true and motivated to finish that one?
Well, because I kept telling myself that, of course, there's better ideas, but you know, you have to finish this first one, otherwise it'll never be finished. You'll just always have other ideas, and you have to, even if you're kind of gritting your teeth, you have to go on with it and finish it. Because it took, you know, 2 years or something between other projects, between paid work, and so, you know, it takes a wee while, and of course you start to think, why did I want to do this? Why shouldn't I? Why I should have done this other thing. But yeah. You just have to try to remind yourself that if you don't finish it, it would be a great shame, because then you don't have anything.
Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. The animation looked great, and I thought it was really cool how you showed VFX, kind of, you know, like the stuff that you did to like compile it together within the Kickstarter video.
Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
I was like, that's so cool. Stop motion is so amazing. Well, I hope you make your short film. That'd be really cool.
We'll see. I'll do something. You know, I feel like I'd be quite happy to keep working, you know, on films and other people's projects, but I'd like to do something else myself.
Yeah, when it's time, you'll know.
Yes. Yes.
Is there anything that, you know, we didn't talk about that you feel passionately to discuss?
No, I think we covered everything. I think you've asked other people about mental health and stuff like that. I mean, that I know it's coming up more and more. People are talking about that. In studios here as well, but for the moment I've been okay, but I can see how people are put under pressure to work late, to work weekends, especially when they're young in the industry, to go give more than they're paid for, and especially in the UK that's quite bad. In France, it's not so bad. They have, labor laws and stuff like that, so people usually work the hours, and there's no big deal if you have to leave at the moment that your day is finished because you have other stuff to do. But I can understand that people feel that they're if you're working late and working weekends because the project is so amazing and you have to give your extra and give everything to it. That's great if you do that for one project and then you go into something that you can kind of work regular hours. But if you're always working on projects like that, then you're always going to be giving far too much and you're going to, get really, really tired and
Yeah.
might decide not to work in animation anymore, which would be a shame. So I think people just have to, take their time and try to avoid the pressure that you get to work too much or feel that you should be there all the time or extra work on weekends and stuff like that, because it's not really healthy in the long term. Not for the studio either, because they lose work.
Yeah, that's so true. It's definitely you see someone else pushing themselves so hard, and you're like, oh man, maybe I should do that. And then it just spreads like wildfire.
Yeah, it's a kind of a peer pressure thing as well. Yeah, everyone's doing this. Are you leaving? No, I'm not leaving.
Yeah. And sometimes they're like, are you leaving? Okay, bye. But then you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be leaving. I've done that before. So,
Yeah.
last question. What do you know now that you wish your younger self knew starting out?
Oh goodness. Kind of what I said there as well, that there are going to be other projects. This is very important, of course, but you can pace yourself a bit. Other jobs will come up. It's important to have good relationship with people, to be, to get on with people as much as possible, your colleagues and things like that. Eventually, it's one of the nicest parts of the job, being able to work with nice people and be inspired by them and see what they're doing and meet them at Annecy or things like that. So focusing on friendships is really, really nice. But I wish I knew when I was younger. That it would be useful to learn French when I was in high school instead of dismissing it as a subject that I would never need and not studying it at all and being very bad at
That's so funny.
it. If someone was someone who's still maybe studying, that there's lots of time to get into the kind of job you want to do and the thing you want to do. It might not be the first job or the second job. I was very lucky with my first job, but lots of people I know, they spent years and years working smaller jobs and then eventually they find something that they like. And sometimes it takes a long time. For me, it took me a while to find animation. I didn't have any idea about animation when I was younger. And I was kind of floating around. And a girl my same age as me said that our generation had luck with that. We were able to kind of bum around and working rubbish jobs and travel and not worry too much about what our career is going to be like. Whereas nowadays people have to know what you're going to do straight away. You have to graduate with really good, and then you have to go into an excellent job straight away and do really well straight away and climb the ladder. And I think maybe we were lucky, or maybe we just put less pressure on, but I think it's good just to relax a little bit and know that eventually you're going to get where you want to be. You don't have to, if it doesn't work out in the first job or the second job or whatever, it will get there eventually. You'll get there
Love that.
eventually.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a wonderful conversation. And
Thank you. It was
you're
really
so
nice.
good. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. It's very nice.
Ink and Paint Folk is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women and non-binary folk in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by the year 2025. Learn more at womeninanimation.org. This episode was produced by me, Cassie Soliday, music by Dominique Parker. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk podcast. Stay colorful.